people of all political persuasions get to know some high highs and some low lows. We jump up and down for joy when the election returns come in some elections, and in other elections we have to pick our jaws up off the floor in response to choices we simply can't abide. So to step way back, there's a question to be asked here. Do we really know what we're doing when we pick political leaders? And today's guest breaks it to us gently, maybe not. Rick Shankman wrote a book called Political Animals, How Our Stone Age Brain Gets in the Way of Smart Politics. Rick Shankman spent many years as a journalist, including running the newsroom at the CBS affiliate in Seattle. He's emphasized history and political history in his work and founded the History News Network, featuring historians commenting on current events. Rick is the author of 7 books, including 2008's Just How Stupid Are We? Facing the Truth About the American Voter. Rick Shankman, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
I'm delighted to be here. Thank you so much.
So I gather you're making money underestimating the intelligence of American voters?
Well, wow, nobody has put it quite that way. I write books for a living, and of course, I hope that they will sell as many copies as possible.
But the fact is that it sounds like you developed some skepticism, and I guess this probably stems out of your journalism career before you even begin to delve into the history part of things.
Well, 8 years ago, I wrote the book, Just How Stupid Are We? Facing the Truth About the American Voter. And I wrote that coming out of the Iraq War experience. The one fact about that war that really just got to me was that on the eve of the war in March of 2003, just as we were about to set our bombers to attack Saddam, polls came out that showed that a majority of the American people believed that the reason we were going to war was because Saddam Hussein was behind 9/11, and they believed that that was a good argument for going to war. So this was so contrary to the facts, I decided I needed to dig into this, find out just how bad the situation was. So I did research, and I wrote my book a few years later, Just How Stupid Are We? After that book came out, I decided I really needed to understand the science behind public ignorance on this colossal scale. It just didn't make sense. The brain has 86 billion neurons in it. It's good enough that it could help us design rockets to go all the way to the moon and build skyscrapers. And yet a majority of the American people couldn't figure out what the most important facts were about the most important event of their time. It didn't make any sense. So I spent 5 years researching it, and the result is Political Animals.
So back to the original thing, though. I mean, what did you... What are a couple areas to go here? Number one, first of all, those poll numbers always seem to defy gravity. You think they're going to sink any day, and they don't, which I'm sure probably surprised you as you looked at that. But the other part of it is that there's obviously this strong belief in that they were deliberately misled. I mean, if you could say a bunch of things about the way the Bush administration handled getting into the Iraq war, this much I did notice from analysis of speeches is that they were very careful about alternating lines in speeches to say Saddam Hussein in one line and then 9/11 in another line, never putting them in the same sentence, but layering them in such a way so that people would think they were all connected.
Well, it was a deliberate ploy of the Bush administration. When cornered, Bush actually did state very clearly in a press conference that, no, Saddam Hussein had nothing to do with 9/11. But if you didn't happen to catch that one little moment in the press conference, it was easy to be misled if you didn't have access to diverse sources of information and if you weren't a thoughtful voter. My concern was, well, why were voters so easily manipulated? And that's really what I was trying to highlight in that book and what I'm trying to explain in this book.
So the title, Political Animals, I mean, it's a phrase we hear a lot, but I guess it's a lot older than people might have thought. Dates back to ancient Greece, is that right?
So Aristotle wrote a lot about politics, and he said we were political animals. And the question is, if we're political animals, why aren't we better at this thing called politics?
That's a major question. So all right, so if we're talking about politics, why does the book start with a few pages on shark attacks in New Jersey 100 years ago?
Well, exactly. So first of all, I tell stories. I'm a historian. That means I like to tell stories. I like to read stories. So the book is a series of one good story after another, illustrating lessons from science that explain how our brain works. And I start off by telling the story of these shark attacks. So 100 years ago, exactly 100 years ago in 1916, the worst series of shark attacks in American history took place off the coast of New Jersey. 4 people in 2 weeks were killed in shark attacks. This is the worst ever. And it was stories about these shark attacks that led to the writing of the book Jaws and the movie Jaws, the famous 1970s movie. So this was a big thing on the East Coast. If you grew up in New Jersey as I did, you heard about these shark attacks all the time. It was in our cultural DNA to be aware of it. So here's the thing. What happened immediately in response to these shark attacks? Well, the hotels in the areas affected were immediately devastated, right? Everybody left. Everybody fled the beaches. Nobody wanted to risk swimming in the waters where they could possibly get killed in a shark attack. This was human beings acting on instinct. And in this case, their instincts worked properly. But then 4 months later, there was a presidential election. Woodrow Wilson was up for re-election, 1916. And in New Jersey, where he had been the governor and the president of Princeton, which was a New Jersey school, of course, he had done very, very well in New Jersey. People there knew him. They felt a strong emotional connection to him. And they supported him. But in the beach towns where these shark attacks had taken place, he plummeted in support.
All right, we'll pick it up there. We'll pick it up there on the other side of a break. We need to take one now, but we'll come back and talk more with Rick Schenkman about political animals and Woodrow Wilson in the 1916 election and how sharks affected his support in those New Jersey coastal communities. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Rick Schenkman and you in 1 minute. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Our guest today is the journalist and historian Rick Schenkman. His latest book is called Political Animals, How Our Stone Age Brain Gets in the Way of Smart Politics, where he makes a convincing case for why our brains aren't quite evolved far enough to handle picking our leaders particularly well. He gives lots of examples. You can join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 and by email at jx@jeffnet.org. So Woodrow Wilson won re-election in 1916, but the very communities that had experienced these 4 deaths by shark attack in 2 weeks, these are the ones that voted a lot less strongly for him?
Yeah, exactly. They voted against him in overwhelming numbers, while the rest of the state voted for Wilson. So what was going on? So Chris Aiken, a political scientist at Princeton, decided to spend a month a few years ago researching this to figure this out. And what he discovered was the effect of the shark attacks was what accounted for people turning against the incumbent, against Woodrow Wilson.
Which
this makes no sense, but it's how our brain works. If something bad happens to us, we lash out at somebody, and it's in a political context, we lash out at the incumbent party. Even if Woodrow Wilson, as the incumbent, could do nothing about these shark attacks. He was president of the United States. He wasn't in a position to help save the people of New Jersey from shark attacks.
But if this analysis had been out there long enough, it seems like one political party or the other or both would have figured out, well, if we just make things seem as bad as they possibly can be, we can win the next election.
And that is exactly what they do. Excellent. Perfect. You've got it.
Okay, conversation over. No. We have much more to talk about. There are 4 basic behaviors that you bring up in the book and that form the 4 basic parts of the book. 1, we disengage and get apathetic. 2, we don't size up leaders correctly. 3, we punish politicians who tell hard truths. And 4, we fail to show empathy when it's called for. Is the basic thesis, though, Rick, that our brains really can't make sense of politics?
So here's the basic thesis. The human brain was basically designed and it evolved during the 2.5 million year period known as the Stone Age. And it was designed to address the problems that hunter-gatherers faced during that period. It wasn't designed to address the problems that we face in the 21st century. And of course, the politics of people living in a multicultural, multipolar world involving millions and billions of people is far different from when you're living in a small group of no more than 150 people. So we were very, very good at politics when we only had 150 people around us. But now that we have millions, we're not very good at it.
So how much evolutionary time might it take our brains to catch up? I'm guessing not by November of this year.
Yeah, no, it takes about 25,000 years, according to E.O. Wilson at Harvard, for any species to undergo really major change, at least a complicated species like human beings, like Homo sapiens. But fortunately, and there is a lot of hopefulness in the book, the last 25% of the book is all about why we have a reason to be hopeful, even though we have these Stone Age brains. Just because we have a Stone Age brain on our shoulders doesn't mean we have to have Stone Age politics. I think that we do have Stone Age politics, but cultural norms can change. And there are all kinds of hopeful lessons in the science that I cite that show all the different ways in which science is giving us the reason to feel hopeful. So let me give you one example.
Mm-hmm.
All human beings come with a feeling of anxiety. Normally, when you feel anxiety, you feel bad, and this feels like that's not a very positive thing. Hey, Rick, why are you telling me about anxiety like that's a positive? Well, here's the reason. When there is a mismatch between our beliefs about the way the world works and the reality in front of our eyes about how it actually is working, we grow anxious. And when the burden of holding on to our belief becomes greater than the burden of changing our belief and becoming open-minded to a new view, well, that is triggered by anxiety. So anxiety is serving the purpose of keeping human brains real so that we don't become trapped by dogma. If we never changed our opinion about anything, we never would have gotten out of the caves. So this is something that all human beings are equipped with, and it's something that we should now incorporate into our politics so that we understand the beneficial part of anxiety. And if you were, for instance, trying to design a television campaign to make people aware and convince them of the problem of global warming, what you would do is try to trigger an anxiety response so that people who don't believe in global warming will begin to feel anxious. There is a problem, though, and you might be able to detect it. The problem is it takes time for us to grow really anxious. So we may need to see the snow cliffs of Greenland falling into the ocean before we get that strong feeling of anxiousness that'll make us want to shift our opinion and recognize, oh, we have a problem. And of course, scientists say if we wait until then, it's too late. So there is a disconnect here, and I'm hoping that television commercials could actually bridge the gap. Maybe with very effective television commercials, we can convince people that global warming is real before they actually start seeing the cliffs falling into the ocean.
There are some examples out there already that people can look at of parts of Greenland falling into the ocean. I remember seeing one that showed up last year from a couple of guys who have been monitoring the glacial movements. But I laughed a little bit because you said very effective television commercials, because I'm thinking about what the rest of this year is likely to be like, which is chock-a-block with television commercials saying, this is why so-and-so is bad for America.
Yeah, well, exactly. And those commercials don't do us any good. Typically, what commercials are doing is almost trying to inspire people to live in fear and to get really angry. And another set of social science lessons that I report on in the book is that when we are angry, our views become more rigid and dogmatic, and we become less willing to change our minds or to even open our minds to contrary facts that may undermine our beliefs. So we don't want to get people angry. We want to get them anxious. And there's two different parts of the brain that are activated. When you're angry, the insula in your brain is the most active module. When you are anxious, it's the amygdala, which becomes really anxious, which becomes really active. So we can see that the more we understand about how the human brain actually works, the better we should be at politics. If we can get this knowledge out there, what I'm trying to do in the book is to educate everybody about, well, basically educate everybody the way I was educated in the last 5 years when I plunged into this research, so that we understand how our brains work, and that will help make us less susceptible to manipulation by politicians.
Well, it's not quite encourage your hopes, not your fears, but it certainly is about not encouraging your fears. So we should be encouraging our unease, our discomfort. How would you characterize this?
It's just focusing on the mismatch. There is a difference between the scientific understanding of anxiety and our day-to-day understanding of anxiety. In our day-to-day understanding of anxiety, we're thinking about growing fearful and kind of having this bit of unease. The scientist's interpretation of or definition of anxiety is when there is this mismatch between our beliefs and the outside world. So that's what I'm really talking about.
Rick Shankman's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Political Animals, How Our Stone Age Brain Gets in the Way of Smart Politics, how our brains are really attuned to living in caves, and they haven't quite caught up with how we live in large groups, larger than the magic number of 150 that we can get to in just a little bit. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange. Your questions and comments on the topic of how we function in a political system are welcome at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So to the parts of the book, and in part one, you talk about we disengage and we get apathetic. But stuff like Obama born in Kenya is one of the things that you bring up. It's been debunked over and over, as was the idea of Saddam Hussein being connected to the September 11th attacks. And yet people hold on. Why?
Belief trumps facts. Drew Wesson is a neuroscientist at Emory who in 2004 put Kerry voters and Bush voters into MRI machines and studied their brain when he was telling them information that was showing that their favorite candidate was guilty of hypocrisy in one form or another. When he put the Bush voters in there and showed them an example of Bush hypocrisy, what did they do with the bad information that they were hearing? They didn't want to hear it, obviously. It was conflicting with all their other beliefs about Bush. So they shunted it aside, and literally parts of their brain that normally would be active in trying to digest new information went silent. They went radio silent. The same thing happened with the Kerry voters when they were presented inside the MRI machine with examples of hypocrisy of John Kerry. What this suggested to Drew Wesson was that what the brain tries to do when it hears information that's contrary to belief is shut it off. And when the brain does shut it off, it feels better. We feel better. So this is very problematic in politics, because a lot of politics is all about trying to educate people about what's going on in the real world. It's every 4 years that we learn more about how our system works, and we get into the weeds a little bit. But if the human brain resists basic facts that are contrary to belief, well, that shows that we have a problem in democracy. Now, we are not slaves to our Stone Age brain. We can get around this, but we have to become aware of our proclivity and our bias against beliefs that are contrary to what we, against facts that are contrary to our beliefs. So that's part of what I'm trying to do, is just make us aware of our own brain, how they operate, so that all of us, liberals, conservatives, people in the middle, all of us understand how our brain works.
You really got it right down to a nice succinct phrase there: belief trumps facts. And that doesn't appear to be the way we handle it. If our brains don't handle politics well, though, that this should be a universal, that other countries should have some of the issues we have, do they?
Well, when institutions, political institutions are weak, you're going to see people relying on their Stone Age brains more. So 50 years ago in this country, we used to have voters taking cues from party bosses, labor union bosses, church leaders. That, by and large, doesn't really happen very much in the modern world that we're living in now. So that's putting the burden on people themselves to try to figure out what's going on politically. That's thrown them onto their Stone Age brains much more so than our ancestors were, our grandparents were. And that's why we're having so much more trouble in politics now than we were a half a century ago. And in other countries, they're still taking cues from political institutions, and at least in some of these countries, like in Scandinavian countries, they have strong cultural and political institutions that can help people take cues for how they ought to think about politics. In America, where we celebrate the individual, we're not taking cues from anybody anymore. We're just out there and we're just trying to figure it all out on our own. And that creates a real problem.
There's some interesting efforts you bring up in the book, though, and one of them is James Fishkin and the deliberative poll. What is it and how did it work?
So James Fishkin is currently a Stanford political scientist, and he came up with this idea back in the 1990s about deliberative polls. So in a regular poll, you go out and you survey people about their opinions, and they tell you what their opinion is about Barack Obama or whoever, and then the pollster says, "But," and he walks away. In a deliberative poll, you take a bunch of people in a room, you survey what their opinions are, and then you sit them down for the next week or 2 weeks or for some extended period of time, and you plunge them deep into facts about politics. And you take the time to educate them about all the issues that you're asking them questions about. So you're deliberating, hence deliberative poll. And Fishkin's point of view is that if you do that, you can educate people out of ignorant opinions. And lo and behold, democracy actually works. Well, the problem with this is I don't think there was ever any question that education works. That's why we send people to grade school and grammar school and to college. We know that education works. The problem is motivating people. So unless you're enrolled in one of these James Fishkin deliberative poll enterprises, you have to show initiative on your own to figure things out. And few people actually do that. Outside of a handful of a relatively small number of political junkies in the country, about 9% of American voters, the rest of us are out there. We're busy with our lives. We're not so focused on politics that we're studying everything. And that's the problem. How do you motivate millions of people for whom politics isn't their first love? And the problem that we've got is that in small communities of 150, politics is all around us. It's in our immediate environment. So we're, of course, engaged. We're not apathetic. And our Stone Age brain inclines us to be really good at politics when it's happening in our immediate vicinity. But when you're members of a large group consisting of millions of people, as we are as citizens of the United States, well, it's very easy to grow apathetic because who cares what's happening five counties away or five states away or 5,000 miles away. Our brain isn't configured to respond to cues that are taking place in remote areas like that.
Which brings us into how our brains function just in trying to pick people, particularly from a distance. And the whole second section of the book is that we don't size up leaders correctly. And you start with the example of John Edwards. He fooled a lot of people, but I mean, how could we know?
Well, this is the problem. Reading people is extremely hard, but when we see them on television, we have an instant like or dislike for them. This is the way the human brain is configured. So within 167 milliseconds, we reach a conclusion about somebody, whether we like them or we dislike them. And if we take more time, let's say 2 or 3 seconds instead of 167 milliseconds, which keep in mind, that's faster than it takes to blink your eyes. We don't rethink our reaction. We just hunker down more and become more convinced that our initial 167 millisecond view of this person is the correct view. So this is something about the way the human brain works. And why is that? It's because back in the Stone Age, there was it was very important for people to make up their minds very, very quickly about threats. If you came upon a stranger, you need to size them up instantly. Otherwise, you could wind up dead. Well, that's not true in politics. You have months, years before the next election. You don't have to make up your mind fast, but we do because that's how the human brain works. So what I am calling for in the book is a recognition that anytime we have that instantaneous response to a politician we see on TV, a flare should go off in our brain that says, whoa, we don't really know who this person is. Even though our brain is convincing us that we do, and we need to second guess our first impressions.
So we need to tell ourselves that we need to give somebody a second chance to make a first impression or a first chance to make a second impression, whichever way you want to phrase it.
Well, what we need to do is really dig into the person's background and understand them as much as we possibly can by reading up about them, because we can't trust our instincts in this. It's just very, very difficult, though, to convince people of this, because life teaches us that we can trust our instincts, because we use this instinct all day long. The difference is, when you see somebody on TV, that's different from making an assessment of somebody that you come upon in a crowd, on a sidewalk, or somebody, you know, a colleague at work who you see all the time. And it just doesn't work that way. That's the problem. We can't trust our instincts here when we want.
All right, not from a distance, certainly. Much more to talk about with Rick Shankman. His book is Political Animals, How Our Stone Age Brain Gets in the Way of Smart Politics. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Rick Shankman, and your phone calls and emails when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Rick Shankman, journalist and historian and the author of several books. His book in 2008 was called Just How Stupid Are We? Facing the Truth About the American Voter. He went into further research to come up with his latest book called Political Animals, How Our Stone Age Brain Gets in the Way of Smart Politics, with the basic thesis being our brains are well developed for living in caves and in small groups, and we don't live in caves or in small groups anymore, and so we make mistakes, particularly with things like politics. Join us on the exchange with your perspectives, 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So this idea about researching further and getting more information other than the hit we get from seeing somebody for the first time, particularly on television, there's a great example here. Robert Gates, who was the defense secretary who stayed on when the Bush administration left to become Obama's first defense secretary, talked about working with Hillary Clinton. What did he think when the days were approaching?
I tell this story in the book. Robert Gates met Hillary Clinton for the first time when he's serving in the Obama cabinet, and he's defense secretary and she's secretary of state. And he starts working with her, and he realizes, gee, the public image of Hillary Clinton that he had absorbed, and really he didn't trust her. And then he discovers in working with her, oh, she's really not at all like her public image, not at all like the woman that I saw in little sound bites here and there. And he changed his mind about her. Well, if Robert Gates, who served under many, many presidents in high positions of authority, could be fooled by the public image of somebody and not really understand who they are, even though he thought he knew they are, who they were. Imagine all the rest of us, what position we're in. And yet we go with those first impressions that we have. And I argue in the book that we shouldn't.
Well, is this why, I mean, considering the fact that none of us generally have met John F. Kennedy in person, we cling to this view of him as the leader of Camelot, the fair-haired president, all that sort of thing. When if we take John Edwards to task for his philandering, John F. Kennedy was like John Edwards times 1,000. And yet we still revere him.
Yes, and I have a section of the book about Kennedy. So when people are asked to evaluate the presidency of John Kennedy, they really aren't evaluating the presidency. They are evaluating their impression of him as a man. It's a totally different question. But the way our brain works, when we are asked a hard question and we don't really have a lot of knowledge, you know, how many people outside of historians can cite chapter and verse about the Kennedy administration? So what we do is we answer the easy question. The easy question is what we think of him as a man. And that's based on visual imagery. And basically, you know, we see these little home movies of the Kennedy family, and we think of him delivering his inaugural address. And these images are dancing around in our head. He's very, very attractive figure on camera. And that formed for millions of Americans the basis for their impression of who John Kennedy actually was. And yet, when you think about it in these terms and see the way I framed it, it's obvious that, well, that's really not a strong basis for making an assessment of who he was or what his presidency was like. But that is what our Stone Age brain does, and we do it automatically. And because we do it automatically, we have confidence in our judgment.
All right, let's take some calls. Let's go to Mark in Reading. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Rick Schenkman. His book is Political Animals.
Good morning. Do you have any understanding of the reason or reasons that people in this country no longer accept the precepts of the union bosses, the party bosses, the religious bosses?
Yeah, why we don't do that anymore. Okay, good question. Thanks for that, Mark. Appreciate it. What do you say, Rick?
Well, this is a story that I told in Just How Stupid Are We? It's basically just a decline in our institutions. So we used to have 25% of adult American workers who were enrolled in unions. Beginning in the 1960s, the union movement just began collapsing all around us. So people aren't taking cues from their union leaders anymore because they're not members of unions. Political parties started to collapse around the time that television arose. There, you can see political parties going down just as television goes up. And that's for very obvious reasons. If you're a candidate running for president, say, in the age before television, the only way that you could get yourself nominated was if you got the support of party bosses. Once television came on the scene, you didn't have to worry about the party bosses. All you had to do was get yourself on TV. The voters would get really excited about you, and that forced the parties to recognize you as a leader and to nominate you rather than somebody else who maybe the party bosses favored. So the party boss system went out of favor, and people started relying on themselves because they could actually see the candidates. Once you could see the candidates on TV in your own living room, you thought, why do I need the party bosses to help me decide who I should vote for? And as for churches, well, evangelical churches and black church leaders, they still do try to offer political advice to their parishioners. But most of the rest of churches got out of that business in part because the IRS threatened them with a loss of their nonprofit status if they became too politically involved.
All right. Another call here from Jim in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Rick Schenkman. Political Animals is his book.
Yeah, your comparison with growing up in a cave. We all grew up in a cave family. One religion. We learned at about 13 not to question, blah, blah. Just switch words to a bigger cave and call it politics. Same thing, to keep peace in the family and whatever. And always remember when they say something was translated, that means it was edited. Thank you.
All right, thanks, Jim. Appreciate that. So what about that? Do we? I mean, are families really good at forming our political stuff? Do we tend to stick with what we got as kids?
We do tend to inherit our political views of our parents. It's not 100%. Obviously, we all know people who changed views from what their parents gave them. And what makes up our political ideas, of course, is very complicated. It's in part what we learn from our parents, what we grow up with, to the experiences that we have. Have we lost a job? Are we prosperous? That kind of thing. And then also there's a genetic component. Up to 50% of your political beliefs probably have to do with your genes. Not that there's a gene for a Democrat and a gene for a Republican, but there are genes that are associated with open-mindedness. And so if you have a lot of those genes, you're probably going to tend to be more inclined to being a liberal than a conservative, because liberals are marked by more open minds, whereas conservatives are more marked by bound to tradition.
All right, let's take another call. We have Bernard in Medford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hello. This is Bernard. I once took a sales course, and they kept emphasizing, say it often enough and it becomes true. What does he think about political slogans today?
political slogans for one thing. And let me add to that, Bernard, the line repeated in the last few years, a lie repeated often enough becomes the truth. Rick, how does that really work in the political mind?
Well, social scientists have demonstrated that once we get a fact in our head, it's very, very difficult for us to dislodge it. We place a priority in our brain on information that we learn initially, and we don't like to revise our views. Our brain tries to be extremely efficient and take shortcuts, so it doesn't like to relitigate anything that it's learned, because it always wants to be to anything new that may come along that poses a threat. So once you learn something, it goes into a part of your brain, and it pretty much stays there unless you take a pickaxe to pull it out and uproot it. It's something the brain doesn't like to do.
All right, well, this explains things like you walk into a room and you recognize there's a table, there's two chairs, there are three people standing in the corner talking. I mean, there are a lot of things you can rule out instantly, but so this is a lot of the problem, is we don't want to go back and challenge really any of our preconceived notions.
Exactly, and if you think about just the brain as an energy machine, you can understand this. The brain consumes 20% of the body's energy, even though it's only 3 pounds. So if you're a 200-pound man, your brain only weighs 3 pounds, but it's taking up 20% of the energy that your body produces. So it's trying to be as efficient as it can because it's already consuming a lot of the energy. It doesn't want to use up any more energy. And the more you force it to work, the more energy it's going to burn, because that means more neurons have to be firing, literally. It's a biological process. So it tries to limit the number of things that it has to think about.
All right, but people do change their minds, and there's a great example in here, and his name is Rick Shankman. You met Nixon and supported him. Why, and what led to you changing your mind over time?
Yeah, exactly. In retrospect, seems like, what the hell were you thinking? I was a high school student, went off to college, and I liked Richard Nixon for some reason, even though I had been raised in a Democratic Party family. But I liked him. He went to China. He opened up China. He went to Russia and created detente with the Soviet leaders. And he was bringing the Vietnam War to a close. And for all those reasons, I thought he deserved re-election in 1972. And I followed Watergate closely. I knew all the facts. I was really attentive. I was a political junkie. But I could not stop liking Richard Nixon, not as a human being, but just liking him as a political figure and thinking that he was a good politician and making a good president. And not until 2 months before he finally resigned, long after the American people had given up on him, I was still in his corner. I mean, it was crazy as I think back on it. And part of I've always been haunted by this personal history of mine. And part of the reason I was so eager to get into the scientific studies was I wanted to understand myself. How is it that I was so taken in? So I'm not just writing about other people here. I'm writing about myself and the way one politician, Richard Nixon, manipulated me.
Well, and you write about other people who still believe that, you know, that Nixon did a lot of really good things. He just was misunderstood, or the whole, like, well, you know, he just got caught and the other guys didn't. And in fact, you point out that 25 of 44 presidents have lied, and that is a provable thing. But it gets to the question of how we act as communities when we do lock around something, not just as individuals. I mean, do we seek out echo chambers of like-minded individuals?
Yes, we do. And of course, that's a real problem for us in this highly polarized country that we're now living in. The more polarized we get, the more likely we are to seek refuge in like-minded communities. And what the social science research says about this is that we really are heading for a dangerous outcome. Because here's what happens. When you remain in a small group of like-minded people, opinions naturally tend to drift toward the extreme. You become more and more extreme. And that's what's happening with our politics. Democrats are becoming more left-wing. Republicans are becoming more right-wing. And the more you hang out with people of your own kind politically, the likelier it is that we're going to become even more polarized. And the problem with that, of course, is that democracy doesn't work if everybody's polarized, and particularly if everybody's angry with each other.
It produces a sense of enemies and otherness, doesn't it?
It does, and the research is very clear that when we're in an angry state, we do not compromise, and we don't have an open mind to somebody else's point of view.
So is the trick then to try to make sure that we read as much as we possibly can, to listen to voices that we don't necessarily agree with? I mean, give us some baby steps here.
Well, first of all, the key thing is to understand how our own mind works. So if you're honest with yourself and you realize, oh, I'm going to be inclined to only listen to people who have the same views that I have, then I need to make a real effort to learn about what other people are thinking. So that means I need to put myself into situations where I am exposed to the views of people who I really don't agree with. And that's a very, very important part of this. So if you're used to reading the New York Times, dip in every now and then to the National Review or the Weekly Standard to see what thoughtful conservatives are saying. That will be one helpful step.
All right. The book is pretty amazing in a lot of ways. Rick Shankman is the author of Political Animals, How Our Stone Age Brain Gets in the Way of Smart Politics. Rick, thanks so much for joining us today on The Exchange.